Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stuttered Kennedy. Chapter 27. Boston. Boston, in the early 80s of last century, was just beginning to demonstrate to a reluctant world that, in addition to its culture, it was, after all, what it had always been, a great commercial city. For the better part of half a century, the most frequently heard word from Boston had been the word of the man of letters. Whether in the realm of philosophy, literature, or religion, until the very name Boston had become synonymous with blue stocking. Half joke, whole earnest, there had been fashioned the legend of Beacon Hill and Beacon Street and their exclusive aristocracy of thought and estate. While men everywhere had heard of the Concord Circle and other circles of less import, those of Prescott, Ticknor, Bancroft, Motley, and Parkman in the realm of philosophy, Lowell, Longfellow, Holmes, and Whittier in the realm of poetry. They were all contemporaries and friends, these men, bound together with many ties of sympathy, and constituted a group of writers that had carried the name of Boston throughout the English-speaking world and beyond its borders. By the early 80s, this race of giants had passed or was rapidly passing away. Emerson died in the April of 1882. Longfellow had preceded him by little more than a month. Alcott, old and war-scarred, lingered peacefully on for another 6 years, and Whittier longer still, as did Holmes and Lowell. But in the 80s, the twilight had definitely descended on the gods, and cultured Boston was resting on its laurels. The Great Fire of 1872 had hastened the change. For two long-remembered days, November 9th and 10th, fire swept over the city south of the Common until nearly 1,000 buildings, most of them in brick and stone, had gone up in smoke. And for the first time in nearly 200 years, men, as they passed along the old cow path of Washington Street, could look back and see the shipping at the wharves away to the south. The devastated area was rebuilt in a surprisingly short space of time. But when a new and finer business district had arisen from the ashes of the old, a new Boston emerged with it. The love of culture and tireless inquiry, which had earned for the city the title of the Athens of America, remained. But it now shared place with trade and commerce. As a great religious center, it was still preeminent, if not from the devotional, certainly from the theological point of view. From the time of Increase and Cotton Mather, through Jonathan Edwards up to Ellery Channing and Theodore Parker, Boston had always been in the forefront of religious controversy. And the Boston craze of today had a way of becoming a national concern of tomorrow. The early 80s of last century found Boston still running very true to form, preoccupied with the question of spiritualism in all its many schools, remodeling its Unitarianism and giving no little attention to the teaching of Robert Ingersoll. Just ripe for something new and revolutionary, It found this quite definitely in Christian Science. It was a sure instinct that decided Mrs. Eddy to look more and more to Boston as the center for the promulgation on a large scale of her teaching. The people who came in increasing numbers to her informal gatherings in the Baptist Tabernacle on Shawmut Avenue were a very different type from those who had heckled her so relentlessly at her first few meetings in the Templars' Hall at Lynn some 4 years previously. They asked questions and raised issues enough, but they did so, for the most part, in the spirit of genuine inquiry rather than of controversy. The headquarters of the movement were still in Lynn, but from now on, Mrs. Eddy found more and more of her work centering in the great city to the south. As 1879 drew to a close, she and her husband once again rented No. 8 Broad Street and moved to Boston, taking rooms at first on Newton Street near Tremont, but later moving with the Choates into a house on Shawmut Avenue, which they took together, Dr. and Mrs. Eddy occupying the second floor, and the Choates the first and third. In the spring of 1880, the Eddies returned to Lynn, but Mrs. Eddy continued to pay her share of the rent and used the Shawmut Avenue house as her resting place when they came to town. Meanwhile, the meetings of the little church each Sunday in the Baptist Tabernacle on Shawmut Avenue became more stabilized, and the attendance steadily increased. Mrs. Eddy generally traveled to Boston from Lynn to conduct the services, which necessarily became less informal as the numbers grew. The meeting would open with silent prayer, followed by the Lord's Prayer, with Mrs. Eddy's interpretation. Then one of the students appointed for the purpose would read from the Bible, and another from Science and Health, after which there would be an address from Mrs. Eddy. Quite often, possibly when the room in the Baptist Tabernacle was not available, the Sunday services would be held in the house of one of the Boston students, generally in that of Mrs. Choate on Shawmut Avenue. Meetings were also held at Lynn, sometimes at No. 8 Broad Street, but more often in the front parlor of Mrs. F. A. Damon's house on Jackson Street. It was a carefully organized gathering, the one at Lynn, with a treasurer and a secretary who kept minutes of each meeting, some of which have been preserved. These minutes show how small, at first, was the whole enterprise. Sometimes 5, sometimes 7, sometimes as many as 20 were present, but seldom more. Thus, the record of the meeting held on September 5th, 1880 runs, "Meeting opened by Mrs. Damon in the usual way. Mrs. M.B.G. Eddy, having completed her summer vacation, was present and delivered a discourse. Whole number in attendance, 22. But all the time, the movement was steadily growing. The Boston meetings, especially, brought in a succession of students to Mrs. Eddy's classes, some of whom were to figure prominently in the rapidly expanding days which lay ahead. Julia Bartlett, Ellen J. Clark, Arthur Buswell, and James Ackland were so eager that they left their work and homes in Boston and came to Lynn so as to study with Mrs. Eddy and commence work as healers under her guidance. Of those who became interested about this time, perhaps the most notable was Julia Bartlett. She was one of the few among the earliest students who remained faithful to their teacher through the years and was still with her at the end. Born in East Windsor, Connecticut, and descended from Robert Bartlett, one of the first settlers in Hartford, she lost her father and mother when she was still a young girl at school, and found herself at the age of 16, the eldest of a family of five. Fortunately, they were all well provided for, and Julia was able to finish her education. But her responsibilities, as she saw them, weighed heavily upon her. She grieved over her father's and mother's death, and turned to religion with a devotion and fervor which only an adolescent girl can show. She was a member of the Congregational Church, which in those days was almost the established church of New England. But its teachings failed to bring her the comfort and assurance she so sorely needed, and she looked in vain elsewhere for help. Finally, she became seriously ill, and in the ebb and flow of partial recovery, gradually lapsed into a condition of chronic invalidism. She first heard of Christian Science in the April of 1880, and never, apparently, doubted for a moment. As soon as possible, she set out for Lynn and placed herself under the care of Dr. Eddy, with the result that she recovered completely. She then went through a class with Mrs. Eddy and returned to East Windsor, determined to make the practice of the new teaching her life work. Later on, she moved to Boston and opened an office there. This growing band of students was at once a strength and a care to Mrs. Eddy. A strength because her one great desire was to have as many as possible put to work, and a care because so few were able to work by themselves. They were forever returning to her for help and guidance, very often when the problem that presented itself was one they could quite well have worked out for themselves. Mrs. Eddy's straight speaking, on many occasions, led to jealousy and offense, and she was called upon, all too often, to settle differences which brought upon her only the condemnation of both parties. She pushed forward, however, and in the December of 1880 launched boldly upon an enterprise which was to bring her teaching at one bound into the very presence of Boston's higher criticism. She hired the Hawthorne Hall, No. 2 Park Street, for her Sunday afternoon services. Almost in the shadow of Park Street Church, Hawthorne Hall, named after Nathaniel Hawthorne, had long been the scene of some of Boston's highest flights into the realm of science, philosophy, and religion. Many great people had spoken and lectured there, and cultured Boston found its way to Hawthorne Hall as readily as it did to Park Street Church or King's Chapel. It was an intimate kind of place, with a good platform, a gallery at one end, and seats sufficiently generous to make for comfort. The services were held at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoons, and they quickly became a subject of much discussion, both in the press and at church meetings, public and private. Up to now, it had all been rumor. Ministers and others had heard of the queer movement in Lynn with mingled feelings of curiosity and strong disapproval, and they had no doubt read about the conspiracy to murder trial with the feeling that it was the final wind-up of a rather discreditable craze. The last thing they could have expected was that they would next hear of this strange teaching from the platform at Hawthorne Hall. It was some time before the storm actually broke, and meanwhile, Mrs. Eddy carried her plans for development a step further by making a move which was certainly not lacking in courage and imagination. Under a state act which had been passed in 1874, she applied for and secured a charter for a college to teach her system of metaphysics. And on January 31, 1881, the charter was granted to the new institution under the title of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College. The purpose of the college, according to its charter, was to teach pathology, ontology, therapeutics, moral science, metaphysics, and their application to the treatment of disease. It was empowered to confer degrees and give diplomas and transact all the business necessary to these ends. As the Act of 1874 was repealed in 1883, and Mrs. Eddy's college was the only institution of its kind to be chartered under it, the Massachusetts Metaphysical College quickly attained a unique position. The founders whose names appeared on the charter were Mary B.G. Eddy, President, James C. Howard, Treasurer, Charles J. Eastman, Edgar F. Woodbury, James Wiley, William F. Walker, and Samuel P. Bancroft, directors. In Charles J. Eastman, Mrs. Eddy had a link with the past. He had been one of her pupils in the little infant school she had organized in the shoemaker's shop behind her sister Abigail's house in Tilton. The founding of the college was characteristic of Mrs. Eddy's method of approach to every development of importance in the work she had set herself to do. What the thing was to be in the end, so it was to her in the beginning. She was always willing to work with the scantiest and most indifferent material, but the project from the first had the full outline of the finished plan. And so she took her charter back with her to Lynn, and a few days later she was writing letters on paper that bore the heading, Massachusetts Metaphysical College, Number 8 Broad Street, Lynn. There was no outward and visible change. Students came and went, and she continued to teach as before, when and as she could. Those who paid and those who could not pay were given a receipt for the fees. but now they were enrolled for a regular college course. And although the granting of degrees came later, the right to confer was there from the first. It was a time of much activity. Early in the spring, the third edition of Science and Health was ready for the press. In it, the deficiencies of the second edition were made good, and the chapter entitled Demonology added, as already noted. But it had hardly gone to the printers before Mrs. Eddy was confronted with another problem, which was to remain a problem for many years to come: the question of plagiarism. On the conclusion of the conspiracy to murder trial, Edward J. Ahrens came immediately to Boston, took an office at 32 Upton Street, not far from Faneuil Hall, and began a vigorous missionary work among the market men in this wholesale district of the city. From the first, he seems to have gone off more or less on his own, fashioning his own ideas and drifting further and further away from Mrs. Eddy and her steadily growing band of students. He occasionally even hired a hall and gave a lecture on metaphysical healing, charging an admission fee of 10 cents. There was no definite break. Indeed, for some time after the trial, he appears to have been specially earnest and wholehearted in following Mrs. Eddy's leadership. But he gradually drifted away. Then, one day, Dr. Eddy received a pamphlet entitled Theology, or The Understanding of God as Applied to Healing the Sick. It was by Edward J. Ahrens, and was, for the most part, a verbatim transcript from Science and Health. The only suggestion of indebtedness was contained in a notation in the preface to the effect that the author had used some thoughts contained in a work by Eddy. The matter came up later in the federal courts, but for the time being, Gilbert Eddy tackled the question with vigor. He seems to have felt it much more than Mrs. Eddy. It was Mrs. Eddy who, later on, steadily pursued a single course until her legal rights were recognized and established, and the purity of her teaching, as she conceived it, safeguarded, as far as she could safeguard it. But it was Gilbert Eddy who took immediate action. He wrote a new preface to the third edition of Science and Health, then in the press, in the course of which he denounced Ahrens' action tersely. If simply writing at the commencement of a work, I have made use of some thoughts contained in a work by Eddy, walks over copyright, any fool can aspire to be wise, commence a book with the announcement that I have taken some thoughts from Ralph Waldo Emerson, and then copy verbatim, without quotation marks, from 30 to 300 pages of his works, and publish them as his own. This may be convenient for an ignoramus or a villain, but a real expounder of the understanding of Christianity or God would scarcely be caught at it. And then, warming to his subject, he continues, "It would require ages and God's mercy to make the ignorant hypocrite who published that pamphlet originate its contents." His pratings are colored by his character. They cannot impart the hue of ethics but leave his own impress on what he takes. But there were other and more serious difficulties ahead. So long as the center of the little community was in Lynn, progress, although difficult enough, was fairly united. Every additional follower added to the prestige of the original disciples, but with the steady rise in importance and numbers of the movement in Boston, the laborers in Lynn, who reckoned they had borne the burden and heat of the day, began very definitely to murmur. They did not like to find that the last recruit in the great city in the South was to receive every man a penny a day. From murmuring, they drifted towards open rebellion, until one evening late in October, at a meeting of the Christian Scientist Association being held at No. 8 Broad Street, one of the members, in behalf of himself and seven others, presented Mrs. Eddy with a memorial, signed by each of them, announcing their intention to withdraw from the association. It was quite an unexpected blow, and must have been with a strange mixture of feelings that Mrs. Eddy scanned the names attached to it. Those of her old and trusted friends, Miranda Rice, Dorcas Rawson, Margaret Dunshee, James Howard, and others. We, the undersigned, while we acknowledge and appreciate the understanding of truth imparted to us by our teacher, Mrs. Mary B. G. Eddy, led by divine intelligence to perceive with sorrow that departure from the straight and narrow road, which alone leads to growth in Christ-like virtues, made manifest by frequent ebullitions of temper, love of money, and the appearance of hypocrisy, cannot longer submit to such leadership. Therefore, without aught of hatred, revenge, or petty spite in our hearts, from a sense of duty alone to her, the cause, and ourselves, do most respectfully withdraw our names from the Christian Science Association and Church of Christ Scientist. Signed, S. Louise Durant, Margaret J. Dunshee, Dorcas B. Rawson, Elizabeth G. Stewart, Jane L. Shaw, Anna B. Newman, James C. Howard, Miranda R. Rice. October 21, 1881. Piecing the scene together from such scanty records as there are, notably Clara Choate's memoirs, it was not lacking in drama or pathos. Mrs. Eddy received the memorial in silence, and the eight students who had signed it filed out of the room one by one without speaking, leaving Mrs. Eddy and Gilbert and two students who remained faithful to make what they could of it. Of these two students, one was most probably Julia Bartlett, although Clara Choate does not mention her name. The other was a new student, already devotedly attached to Mrs. Eddy, and destined to become one of the best-known figures in the movement. His name was Calvin Fry. All that night, as Calvin Fry afterwards recorded in his notes, the four sat together sorrowfully, but bravely enough to find some reparation for what at that period must have seemed a major disaster indeed. Calvin Fry, in his notes, shows how they prayed over it and how, towards morning, Mrs. Eddy suddenly began to speak like one who, thinking herself alone, spoke aloud. It must have made a deep impression on him, for he records her words as well as he could remember them. They are just ecstatic, disjointed phrases, most of them quotations from the Bible, but through them is seen clearly enough the progress of a journey through the darkness towards the light. Is this humiliation, the humility the oppressor would heap upon me? Oh, the exaltation of spirit! I have made thee ruler over many things. Height upon height, holiness, unquenchable light, divine being, the womanhood of God. Well done, good and faithful. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. One woe is past, and behold, another cometh quickly, and no sign shall be given thee. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Woe, woe unto my people! The furnace is heated, the dross will be destroyed. And the false prophet that is among you shall deceive, if possible, the very elect, and he shall lead them into forbidden paths, and their feet shall bleed upon the jagged rocks, and the briars shall tear the rags from them, for they are not clothed with a garment of righteousness. And I will give thee, daughter of Zion, a new heritage and a new people. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. For 3 days they remained together in the house, conferring as to the next step. The final decision lacked nothing, certainly in faith. For on November 9th, 1881, the remnant of Mrs. Eddy's students in Lynn met together and formally ordained their teacher, Mary Baker Eddy, as pastor of the Church of Christ Scientist. And the decision was reached to move the headquarters of the church from Lynn to Boston. And so, a few weeks later, No. 8 Broad Street was dismantled, and on the last evening before Mrs. Eddy and Gilbert were to leave for Boston, a meeting of the Christian Scientist Association was held in the front room that had been the scene of so many meetings during the previous 7 years. There was little business to transact, but Mrs. Eddy spoke to them for a while and finished by reading the 17th chapter of the Gospel according to St. John. As they bore in mind her interpretation of the Christ, the passage probably seemed to the little band singularly appropriate, especially the closing verses. O righteous Father, the world hath not known thee, but I have known thee, and these have known that thou hast sent me. And I have declared unto them thy name, and will declare it, that the love wherewith thou hast loved me may be in them, and I in them.